This week's episode of the Empire Podcast is brought to you in partnership with M&M's Chocolate, helping people showcase their passion and creativity in film. Now, let's start the show. Podcast this week, we have The Right Stuff as we talk to Robin Wright, star of Damsel, and Curtis Steiger's favourite actress, The Wonder Woman, returns to the pod to talk about her new horror film, Imaginary. All that and more on the movie podcast that has just returned from a live show in Norwich, folks. Literally just got off the train and is absolutely, to coin a phrase, partridged. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. Yes, indeed, we are just back from Norwich, folks. Just back from Norwich, leg two of our pod tour in partnership with M&M's. And we were in Birmingham last Friday, kicking things off. And we were in Norwich last night. Very, very exciting indeed. By we, of course, I mean me and my two colleagues of such lethal cunning. Geek Queen Helen O'Hara is here. How are you?
I'm tired. But I'm good.
Because we were out partying last night. Immediately after the show, we just went straight out and we partied.
Partied harder. Yeah, I think partying hardest of all. I went straight to bed. It was pretty lit.
I don't know. We tore up the town, didn't we, Chris? We ordered Domino's to the reception of the Premier Inn.
Yes.
And let me tell you, kids, that's where it's all happening in Norwich.
It was a buzz.
We ate our pizzas in the bar. Where they served actual alcohol. We didn't have any, but it was pretty mad.
Then retired to our chambers. I had not one, but two bottles of Coke Zero. So I was pretty ripped off my tits by the time I got back to my room. And James Dyer is here, of course, our great big fucking nerd. Jimbo, you are, how can I put this without insulting you? You look like you are begging for death.
Yes, I'm very, very tired.
Imagine if we did party hard.
Yeah.
Like, what would we look like? Just desiccated corpses at this point.
I like to think that, you know, if anyone had been in the bar watching us, they would have been proud of how on brand we were, that we sat in the bar eating Domino's, drinking Coke Zero, and arguing about Dune until 1 o'clock in the morning. And then we went to bed.
Yeah, and we went to bed. Amon Mormon was with us last night in Norwich, and then we had no word of a lie. We came back and we just got off the tube and we were walking towards the pod booth, and a guy shouted out as he walked past me and Amon going, "Love your podcast." And I was like, "How did he know it was us?" And I was like, "Oh yes, I was literally loudly saying to Amon, who do you think there will be a fight in the MCU between Ben Grimm, aka, this is literally a quote, the ever-loving blue-eyed thing, and Mark Ruffalo as Bruce Banner?" Just like, oh yes, that's how he knows it's us. It's like the podcast live.
You're a master of disguise.
Yes, you don't have to go to Birmingham or Norwich or Sheffield or Dublin or Salford to get the experience. Just hang around a London street long enough and one of us will walk past banging on about the MCU. But we're having a lot of fun. Sheffield next week. Still some tickets available for Sheffield in the Memorial Hall in Sheffield. It's going to be absolutely amazing on next Wednesday, the 13th of March. And after that is Dublin, the Laughter Lounge, don't laugh, in Dublin on Thursday, March 21st. And then we finish off in Salford/Manchester on March 28th. Tickets are still available for those shows. Dublin is nearly sold out, so get on it quick if you live in the island of Ireland and you wish to see us, north or south, totally fine. And if you want to, tickets are going very, very quickly as well for Salford. That is our biggest show to date, so we're very, very happy to see as many of you there as possible. And of course, Sheffield as well. So we'd love to see as many of you as possible in Sheffield also. As well, I wasn't aware of this until last week, because we are in partnership with M&M's and their M&M's Short Film Festival. You hear more about that in the middle of the show. Every person who buys a ticket to one of our shows gets a free bag of M&M's as well.
Yeah.
Tickets are available via each of the venues, Memorial Hall in Sheffield, Laughter Lounge in Dublin, or Salford Keys Theatre in Salford, or ticketmaster.co.uk, or empireonline.com/podtour. Should we have a listener question?
Sure.
Let's have a listener question. And this is good. And for once, I actually prepared you guys. I told you on the train that this was going to be...
instantly what it was.
You looked at me with disdain, utter disdain, slash horror. slash horror? And the question comes from, I'm going for it anyway. The question comes from Sir S. Hardy on Twitter. Best performance. Mm-hmm. This was inspired because the choice of GIF I had was Jodie Whittaker as Doctor Who, or the Doctor, sorry, in case the nerds come after me. Best performance by a Doctor Who in a movie. So the best performance by an actor who played the Doctor in Doctor Who, but in a movie. Mm. So we have quite a choice. Mm. We have, what, 15 now?
Yeah.
Are we counting John Hurt?
Yeah, we are.
We're counting John Hurt, apparently. That widens the field significantly. So we have William Hartnell, Patrick Troughton, John Pertwee, Tom Baker, Peter Davison, Colin Baker, Sylvester McCoy, Paul McGann, Christopher Eccleston, David Tennant, Matt Smith, Peter Capaldi, Jodie Whittaker, and Shruti Gatwa.
Mm.
All right?
Shruti's okay. Pretty good in Barbie, to be fair.
Yeah, but it's not the answer to the question, is it, though?
Well, no, it's not. You know, I feel like you're going to make a spirited defense for some other people, but it's going to be mm-hmm. John Hurt. And with all due respect.
Why is it going to be John Hurt?
With all due respect.
Why is it going to be John Hurt?
I have questions.
It's going to be Alien.
Assume, for the sake of argument, I know nothing about Doctor Who and think it's true.
You don't have to know anything about Doctor Who.
It doesn't matter.
When did John Hurt play Doctor Who?
He's the war doctor, James Keeper.
What are you talking about?
It was a special episode, and it was revealed that, like, basically there was a war doctor who basically fought against the Daleks, and then kind of he regenerated himself, and he doesn't count himself because, like, he's ashamed of himself.
Okay, when did this become a thing?
I don't know, was it 10, 15 years ago now? It's been a while.
So this is canonical, because he is not listed in the canonical official list. Is this because he's, like, special?
Because he's the war doctor.
I was not certain about including John Hurt, but Helen, who knows this stuff, she was like adamant. No, she knew it has to be John Hurt. John Hurt has to be in there. He is the war doctor.
I don't know anything about Doctor Who. This should be abundantly clear. But yes, John Hurt and Alien is obviously the correct answer.
Why is it the correct answer?
Because he's the best. But if we don't include him because he's a war doctor and we're pacifists.
The war doctor.
Is it Paul McGann in Withnall?
Well, see, this is it. Paul McGann as Marwood.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Who's never named on screen, but, you know, or is I
He's
in
I
Withnall and I.
Oh my God.
That's up there, right? Okay, yes, so you've hit upon someone?
No.
Okay.
It depends on how wide we're casting the net. Because obviously, John Pertwee is father to Sean Pertwee.
Oh, no.
Yes,
he's
I know.
In Equilibrium, so...
he's in Event Horizon.
He's also in Event Horizon, yes.
So
that would
he's Smithy in Event Horizon.
Yeah, that would...
Okay. No, that's...
There is a difference there. I mean, actually, he's done some voice work, hasn't he? So technically, he might cut.
He also is the voiceover dude on MasterChef The Professionals. But no, we're not allowing...
Again, that's not Dr.
Sean
though.
Pertwee. Yeah. We're not allowing Sean Pertwee. We are allowing John Pertwee. Mm. Right, should we do this in an orderly and methodical fashion?
Almost certainly not.
All right, I'm going to try. I'm going to try to impose some structure upon
Give
events.
Give it a go.
Okay, so let's go through them in order, shall we?
Right.
Okay. So William Hartnell, I will hold up my hands. I do not know William Hartnell's film career that much. I do know that he was in Carry On Sergeant, the first Carry On movie.
We have a winner.
Opposite Bob Monkhouse. But I'm saying that I'm disregarding that. Okay, I'm sorry, William Hartnell. You probably starred in like 3 or 4 classics that I'm unaware of. Apologies. Then we go on to Patrick Troughton.
Mm-hmm.
Patrick Troughton, of course, famously was in The Omen.
Yeah.
One of the greatest horror films of all time. Suffered one of the greatest screen deaths of all time. Has one of the greatest lines of all time. His mother was a jackal!
Well, I mean, like, it wouldn't be that clever if his mother literally was a jackal, though, would it?
But his mother literally was a jackal.
Well, then he's just stating facts.
Yeah, he's just stating the obvious.
But it's the way he says it.
Oh,
it's
okay.
The way he says it. But he dies, of course, that famously, he gets impaled by that falling rod steady outside a church in Fulham, I believe. That's where he pegs it. He's literally pegged in, not in the Deadpool sense, but in another sense, in the Omen. Mm-hmm. And that's a great performance and a great movie. So I'm immediately putting Patrick Troughton to the top of the list. Then we have John Pertwee, mm-hmm. right? John Pertwee, again, was someone who was in a lot of Carry-Ons. He was in Carry On Screaming, the greatest of all Carry-Ons. But the film that I remember him in most is one of those anthology horror movies from the 70s that were very, very popular, The House That Dripped Blood. He played a horror movie actor, if I'm remembering rightly, who... has a cloak. He's playing a vampire in a movie and he has a cloak and the cloak is haunted and turns him into a vampire. He's very good in that segment.
Okay.
Yeah. But I'm still saying Patrick Troughton, number one for me right now.
Right now.
What about Tom Baker? Tom Baker, for many people, the best doctor. But did he have the best, does he have the best filmography? He was in a Sinbad movie. I remember that. But otherwise, nothing's really standing out to me, sadly.
No, I think his best work was, well, first of all, being himself, which he did brilliantly, and being the Doctor. But yeah.
No. He's in Dungeons and Dragons, but unfortunately not that one.
Oh dear, the bad one.
Oh no.
Yeah. Oh no.
That's not fair.
Okay,
he
okay. So Patrick Troughton's still number one so far?
Oh, so far.
So far. All right. Let me move on to Peter Davison, who was my Doctor, the Doctor I kind of grew up with. So, but again, from a film point of view, I'm not saying there's a lot there.
Not a huge amount.
Yeah.
Very good work as the Doctor. He was a good Doctor.
Very good work
good
as the Doctor.
Doctor. Well done.
Lots of TV work. Well done him. But unless I'm missing something, I don't see a film that really stands out. So Patrick Troughton is holding firm. He's
okay,
holding
but
steady.
We've got a long way to go, Chris.
We've got a long way to go. Okay. Then Colin Baker.
Yeah.
I'm saying Colin Baker isn't really pulling up any trees film point of view either.
Not a huge amount from a film point of view, sadly.
Okay. Very, very sad. Very sad. But then we move on.
Yeah.
To Sylvester McCoy.
I have a vote here from Sebastian the Hedgehog. And Sebastian says that Radagast the Brown is a contender.
Okay, but does does Radagast the Brown, does Sylvester McCoy eclipse Patrick Troughton just because he's in a couple, maybe all three of those Hobbit films, and because of the size of them, and obviously at the box office, he's run away the number one. And I think he probably is number one once you add all the other doctors together, even John Hurt. I think no other doctor eclipses Sylvester McCoy at the box office because of the three Hobbit movies, right?
How many, was he in all three?
I think he might have been all three. He was certainly in all one. I'm not sure. But even then, that's like, the first one was like a billion. So
There's one question mark I have over that, but yes, I think you're probably right.
All right. But I'm still saying that Patrick Troughton's role alone as father, I want to say Brennan in The
Lord.
Omen is iconic. Radagast the Brown, not iconic. Therefore, I think it's still Patrick Troughton, guys.
It's still early days. Let's
it's
move
still
on.
Early days. All right. Okay. McCoy, you're out of here. Paul McGann.
Who was in, lest we forget, Lesbian Vampire Killers. So let's not overlook that unsung masterpiece.
Let's overlook that. Let's move on.
I think, sadly, Patrick Troughton, you are about to be eclipsed. You have been caught at the fence by Paul McGann because With Nell and I is just one of the greatest movies of all time, as is The Omen. But he's in it for a lot longer than Patrick Troughton, and he doesn't get a rod through his body.
No, though he does get eaten in Alien 3.
He does get eaten in Alien 3. That is true.
Okay.
All right, I'm saying Paul McGann, edging ahead.
All right.
Edging ahead. Now it gets tricky.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now it gets tricky. Because into this equation, we introduce Christopher Eccleston.
Yeah.
Now, what a filmography. What a filmography. Shallow Grave, Thor the Dark World, Gone in 60 Seconds. What?
28 Days Later.
28 Days Later.
Shut up. Yes, also 28 Days Later. So are we saying on the sheer body of work that he's done, because Paul McGann, I love him, but there's one iconic movie there. But do we think that sheer weight of numbers means
I guess the question is, does Chris Eccleston gain or lose points from Malekith?
He's points neutral. Points neutral in that one. I don't know. I'm saying McGann. I'm still saying McGann because that performance, that film is hard to beat. It's hard to beat. Helen, you're going to help me out here because I don't know when to introduce John Hurt.
Okay.
But we're going chronologically.
Sorry, technically you've had him already, but yeah.
Okay, see, I'm really confused now. So when did he come into it?
He comes before McGann.
But he was introduced in the show after or during someone else's run, wasn't
it?
It
was
Smith or Tennant?
Later,
Was it Tennant or Smith?
Tennant, I think. Okay. It was a special. I think it was Smith.
All right. Okay. Let's move on to David Tennant next. Mm. David Tennant.
The best Doctor. Yep.
Great TV career.
Yeah. Mm.
Less less stellar, slightly, I would say, filmography.
Yeah.
Though he is Barty Crouch.
Yeah.
Lest we forget.
So that was the only thing that was giving me pause. I was like, is he in any of the other Harry Potters?
No, I don't think so. It's just the one.
So in that case, yeah, it's still Sylvester McCoy as the box office champ. Which
is that what you were thinking?
That was my
question. Oh, okay.
He was also in one of the How to Train Your Dragons.
Yes,
maybe even
a couple of
one.
Them. Yeah, no, he's in a couple of them. Spittle out.
Yeah, so that actually might change the box office. If we're including voice work, sure.
You sure about that?
Yeah.
Those movies. Okay.
Look, right. This is all academic.
Yeah.
Because the next actor was in Morbius. So let's move on and crown him now.
But David Tennant's interesting because you're right. He's got this amazing career on the small screen, but it perhaps hasn't translated entirely to the big. And I think that is the big screen's loss because he is mad charismatic. Don't know why I said it like that. He's mad charismatic. He's very, very good. He's endlessly versatile. And I think that is a shame on Hollywood, quite frankly, for not putting him in more movies. If Fright Night, the remake of Fright Night, is your big screen highlight, then something's gone wrong.
He has simply focused on the small screen, which, exactly, as we all know, is superb.
Nope.
Yes.
But he has done very good work. But he is good in How to Train Your Dragon and things like that. He was really good in Fright Night. Like, he's very funny.
He was good in that, but not as good as the original.
No, indeed.
But a very good opposite Colin Farrell, regardless. Right. Who'd be a great doctor, by the way, Colin Farrell?
Oh, my God.
Sexy doctor.
Oh, my God. Whoa. I'm sold.
Where are you going with that sonic screwdriver? Next up, Matt Smith, star of Morbius.
Yes.
And one of the Terminators. Genesis?
Genesis.
He's Genesis.
He's the T-5000.
Yes.
It's so bad.
He's also in Last Night at Soho, though, which
he
was
is. Yes, that he is true.
And he was in Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. But he's good in it. Like, he is good in it. It's just that then there are zombies, and you're like, oh, why are you interrupting my Pride and Prejudice movie?
Because they're improving Jane Austen's snorefest, Helen, obviously.
They didn't, though. That's the point, isn't it?
Yeah.
They failed to do
very
that.
Bad film.
But yeah, look, again, maybe has had his better work on the small screen. And he's very good on stage, as is Tennant, we should say, by the way.
Tennant's
fantastic on stage. And I saw Matt Smith do American Psycho on stage, and he was pretty darn good.
Did you? That's good. That's exciting. But yeah, some decent movies. But I'm still saying that no one has shaken off Paul McGann just yet. So I'm going McGann, then Troughton. Okay. Then I'm going Eccleston. I'm ranking them.
Okay.
McGann, Troughton, Eccleston, Smith, Tennant. Those are my five at the moment.
Tennant over Smith. No.
In terms of movie career?
Oh, yeah, for sure. He's got Harry Potter, a bunch of How to Train Your Dragons, and a good bit of Fright Night.
Did you hear Morbius and Terminator Genesis? Did you hear? Okay,
yeah, I
hear it come out of my mouth. Yes. Now I see that. Okay, so I'm going McGann, Troughton, Eccleston, Tennant, Smith. All right, but now we introduce
Hurt.
Do we introduce Hurt?
Yes, we do.
Okay, John Hurt. John
Alien.
Hurt. Boom. Great. Yes. It's a great movie.
Yes.
He does die in it.
But he also has one of the great death scenes.
Helen, I'm not willing to include doctors who have iconic death scenes and iconic horror movies on this list. All right? So I'm going to put him level with Patrick Troughton. Damn it.
But he's also in V for Vendetta.
He is in Fear for Fame.
He's also the Elephant Man.
He is the Elephant Man.
Yeah. He is very good. It's quite hard to get past
John
Hurt.
But is his career overall better than Paul McGann?
Yes.
Is With Nell and I, is Alien?
Yes.
Yes, it is.
But it's a technicality. No. He's not a proper doctor.
He's a doctor.
He's not a... Chris may have you there. He's not a canonical doctor.
He is a canonical doctor. He's
a physician's assistant.
Doctor.
Helen, the official canonical list, by which I mean the one that's on Wikipedia, does not list John Hurt among the numbers.
He's not a numbered doctor, but he is an incarnation of the doctor. He counts as a doctor.
You're an incarnation of the doctor.
Thank you. That's really nice.
All right, we'll set him to one side of the time being, and maybe Whovians can write in or, you know, pick at us or whatever, and tell us whether they think he is canonically a doctor. But yeah, okay, fair enough. I will put John Hurt begrudgingly at the top of the list. But then we have another wrinkle, don't we? We have Peter Capaldi.
It's not a very nice thing to say. He's got
lovely wrinkles. He's a very, very fine looking man. Peter Capaldi next.
Thinker.
He is the thinker in the Suicide Squad. He's also Malcolm Tucker in The Loop, a performance for which I think he should have been Oscar nominated. He's sensational in that film. He is in Local Hero.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a belter, isn't it?
More than that, he's in Paddington 2.
He is in Paddington and Paddington 2.
Is he in Paddington 1 as well?
He is in Paddington as well. Yeah, he's Captain Brexit.
Mr. Curry, isn't
Mr. Curry,
it?
Yeah, the racist neighbour. And then we have...
he's in Benediction. He's very good in Benediction.
He is very good in Benediction.
Although really awful in The Personal History of David Copperfield.
Yes, indeed. And of course, he has an Oscar. He has an Oscar.
Yeah.
That he won for Best Live Action Short with Franz Kafka's It's a Wonderful Life a few years ago. So does your beloved John Hurt have an Oscar, Helen? Does he? Does your beloved Radagast the Brown have an Oscar, Helen?
He has a hedgehog.
Huh?
He can play the spoons.
What's that?
He can play the spoons.
Oh, can he now?
Yeah, he did it on this very podcast.
What about Christopher Eccleston? You know, even Malekith the Accursed does not have an Oscar. So therefore, I'm thinking Capaldi's creeping up. He's creeping up. And then we have Jodie Whittaker. Good work. Venus, great film. You ever seen Venus?
Venus is fabulous.
Such a great film.
Peter O'Toole.
That was her big breakthrough, wasn't it? Really?
Journeyman. That scene on the phone with Paddy Considine. Oh my God. Acting doesn't get any better than this. So I think...
Attack the Block.
Yeah.
St. Trinian's 2, The Legend of Fritton's Gold.
Not so much.
You haven't helped. You haven't helped, frankly.
You think you've helped, but you haven't.
No, you haven't. If anything, you've hindered.
Yeah.
But are we saying top five? Top five? Oh. Are we putting her in the top five?
Pretty solid.
Solid stuff?
Yep.
Okay. And then finally, Shuti Gatwa, who doesn't quite have the body of work on the big screen yet, but he was in Barbie.
He was.
So maybe he's the box office champ.
I mean, per film, if you average it out, he's doing pretty well.
Yeah, maybe he is. Maybe he is. Sylvester McCoy, I'm just going to look it up real quick. He was in all three Hobbits, so he's nearly $3 billion at the box office. So I think he's going to be okay for the time.
Slightly depressing to me that those films make quite so much money, but I suppose it's good for, you know,
dragons.
All right, so if we're allowing John Hurt... So
we are allowing John Hurt.
So John Hurt.
Sir John Hurt.
Probably. Sir John Hurt. Oscar winner, Peter Capaldi.
But not for his acting.
No. Paul McGann.
Uh-huh.
Oh, God. Jodie Whittaker.
Ooh. Okay. All right. Ooh.
Christopher Eccleston.
Hang on.
Oh, I put Patrick Troughton above Peter. Okay. John Hurt. Peter Capaldi.
Uh-huh.
Paul McGann.
Okay.
Patrick Troughton.
And a partridge.
Jodie Whittaker. Christopher Eccleston.
Oh my goodness. This is competitive right now.
Tennant.
Smith.
Gatwa, just for Barbie alone.
Yep.
And then everyone else.
All right.
Does that sound good?
I think that sounds
good. All right. I think we have definitively answered that question. Let's move on. If you want to have your question read out in the Emperor podcast, you can get in touch with us on Twitter. And that is the only game in town. I'm at Chris Hewitt on Twitter. You can slide into my DMs. You can reply to any of my tweets. Once you've stopped laughing, of course, or you can reply to a panicked shout out every now and again, as happened on the train back from Norwich this afternoon. All right, should we have a guest?
Let's do it.
We have Robin Wright, and this one's a bit tricky, DeWanda Wise, star of Imaginary, which hasn't happened yet. It's due to happen at 7 p.m. tonight, and there's a chance it may not.
Well, then let's start with Robin Wright.
Let's start with Robin Wright. I like your thinking.
Yeah, my princess buttercup herself.
So Damsel is out this week on Netflix. As you're listening to this, it is a fantasy action movie starring Millie Bobby Brown as a princess who is betrothed to a young prince in a faraway kingdom. She thinks she's got it made. She hasn't, because she is actually going to be used as a sacrifice to a nearby dragon. And the movie is about how she gets out of that situation. In this movie, Robin Wright, who of course was
Princess Buttercup
in
The Princess Bride,
which is a film that you quite like.
I love it.
Robin Wright plays the evil, spoiler alert, you'll know the second she steps on screen, the evil Queen Isabel, who is behind this nefarious plan.
Ooh.
And I caught up with her on Zoom this week. She was in London. We were meant to be face to face, but as you can probably tell, I have a cold. I don't care about the well-being of these two losers, but I do care about the well-being of Robin Wright, who was
Princess Buttercup
in
The Princess Bride,
and many, many other things as well, including Claire Underwood in House of Cards. We talked about that, about how she's shifted into directing over the years and about how she approaches acting in general. Do please enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on the Emperor Podcast by the star of Damsel, Robin Wright. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm okay, cold notwithstanding, but I'm okay. I'm not at death's door, which is good. But welcome to London. How's London treating you so far?
I love this country.
I often ask our guests this, you know, do you have any London tips? What are your haunts? What are Robin Wright's London sightseeing tips?
Some of the restaurants would be at the top of my list. Like, come to the city to eat here. Yeah.
But is there a restaurant that you'd recommend?
Do you know what I'm dying to go to? I went to the one in Scotland. It's Dishoom.
I was there on Wednesday night in Birmingham.
Oh, yes. I have to go this week. It's just, I can't wait. I can't wait.
There you go, Dishoom. I can't be the only person who has mentioned The Princess Bride to you when discussing this movie.
You are not the first person.
I am so shockingly unoriginal, as to be said. But you can see why people would draw comparisons. It's a very different film tonally. But when you were first told about this project, The Princess Bride must have run through your head as well.
It actually didn't until somebody recently in a press junket brought up, do you think this is Princess Buttercup grown up? And I said, how dare you? Don't ever put her in that category. And then I thought to myself, well, maybe Princess Buttercup just grew up and became hormonal and angry.
Because we don't want to give it away too much, but I think people will be able to figure out that Queen Isabel in this is perhaps not on the up and up, shall we say.
Not on the up and up, but you know what? She's got a damn good cause she's fighting for.
She does. Which I guess plugs into something that, you know, whenever I talk to actors about playing characters of a, how should we say, villainous stripe, A lot of actors will tell me that they don't think of their character as villainous, that they plug themselves into their character's worldview and they're just doing what they need to get by. Is that how you saw Isabel in this one?
I think any role, you have to like who you are immersing yourself in, whether in life you don't believe in their philosophies or they're completely immoral. You have to like the person you play, otherwise it's not going to be very believable, right?
Is that always the case?
I mean, I think so. I think it makes it more authentic as an actor, the feeling that basically generates. You're just like, oh yeah, she is doing what she's doing for some very benevolent reason.
As far as you can see, from a certain point of view.
That's
But it's interesting what you said there about that reaction you had when another journalist brought up the idea that Queen Isabel is Princess Buttercup grown up. That sort of proprietorial view that you had towards Buttercup, that sort of protective feeling that you have towards her. Is that something that just happens naturally as an actor, that you develop these feelings towards your characters, and even when you're done with the project, you can't imagine, you kind of imagine a life for them beyond the film, I'm guessing.
I love how deep you're going with all this. I'm like, I haven't even thought about that. Maybe you should do another podcast where you're, you know, training actors.
Well, talking people through their process.
Talking them through their, the character development, and maybe this is the backstory, and maybe this is the connect. I think you've got a whole other career.
Yeah, but that's a nice way of telling me I should give this career up, Robin, but so thank you.
Oh, no, just you're too timing.
True, I'll moonlight as a therapist for actors. But do you think of your characters that way? I mean, I I've talked to many actors over the years who find characters hard to shake. And when you finish a project, even if it is
something like The Princess Bride or something like Forrest Gump, can you let those characters go? As they grow in the pop culture, you must have feelings towards them.
It's a job. Like any other job, it's a job. No, that's not true. It's not like any other job. It's like a lot of jobs in that you have to go there, quote, emotionally, right? To get to certain beats, to convey this of the character. And I think that is something that you feel very protective internally about once you depart that movie or you leave that character. It's not that you hold on to it, but you almost have a soft spot for certain performances, let's say. Like people are like, what's the most memorable experience you've ever had playing who? There are definitely specific ones that you go, oh, I loved playing that character. Like I did a movie years ago called She's So Lovely that John Cassavetes wrote.
Oh.
I mean, that right there was the biggest gift of my career, was to be able to say his words.
Yeah.
And I love all of his movies.
Yeah.
That's a special one in my heart. And the character I got to play and I got to create was just a blast.
That is so lovely. Pun not unintended.
Yeah,
but
no pun intended.
No, absolutely. Because I was thinking about, you've had this amazing career, and I was thinking about the great directors you've worked with, and I have a kind of list in my head. So I'm thinking, obviously, Rob Reiner, David Fincher, M. Night Shyamalan. I'm thinking Bob Zemeckis. I met him twice, so I can call him Bob. People like
first
that. First name basis. We're all pals, he and I. But he's obviously someone you've worked with a number of times. Are they the directors you think of as the great directors you've worked with? And what does it, when do you recognize you're working with greatness?
It's an interesting question, because when you're an actor yourself and then you direct, we know what we go through. We know what we have to go through to get there. So it's a different vernacular, I think, a lot of the time. One of the greatest experiences I ever had, director to actor, is Anthony Minghella.
Yes, of course.
What a special being he was. I loved the way he directed, because he would talk in story, not the story you're playing. He would bring a story to life that was a great analogy, a great example of emotion that he was trying to get you to achieve. And all of a sudden, you would just feel this manifestation of, oh my goodness, he was just talking about a story of his life or something he heard from a friend. Or that was incredible as an actor, to receive that way instead of receiving line readings or just being thrown an adjective, a descriptive word. He was a storyteller.
So instead of just saying simply faster, more intense, he would get into it.
And faster, better.
Yeah. Could you do that a little bit better? A bit quieter, please? That'd be great. That's fascinating to me. And, you know, I imagine those are conversations as well you had with him before you even got to the set. Have you had an experience, perhaps in your career, where you've got to the set and the director has said something to you that has made you rethink your performance or how you're going to approach something on the day completely? Or do you have to be in lockstep with the director before you even set foot on a set?
No, this is a great example. House of Cards. David Fincher's basically selling me this idea of this show that's a platform that will be the future, called streaming, right? And I said, I don't know if I want to be stuck on a TV series. I did that years ago on a daytime soap opera, and I think I'm still traumatized from that. So I don't know if I want to not be able to do other things. And I really said, I don't want to just be a character that's arm candy to whoever I'm co-starring with. And he said, no. This is going to be a character that will evolve in front of our eyes, and you will see the growth and reformation of this woman that becomes this. And in answer to your question, I was asked by the team, like, do you want to meet politicians? Do you need to meet the first lady from, you know, 2000, blah, blah. And I said, I don't know. I really don't know how to find this character. And so I went to David and I said, I'm lost and we're about to start shooting. And he said, throw all of that out the window. Claire Underwood is a bust. It's the bust, the marble bust that you see if you were to walk into the Capitol in Washington, D.C., and you see all those busts of our founding fathers. You are the female founding father. And what that did is it helped me to understand a stoicism that I wanted her to have, a regalness. Because if you put an animal to your character, I always saw her as like the American eagle, right? The wingspan's massive. They rule the roost of that breed, right? And that's kind of how I came about the Claire Underwood, who doesn't speak very much. And I remember us talking about less is more with her. And it's very, it's Lady Macbeth.
Yeah.
If you think about the bust and everything else. And so that helped create that character. I wasn't in DC talking to politicians ever.
That's the David Fincher touch. And it's fascinating as well, Robin, because obviously you have made the transition into directing over the last few years, and you directed the final episode of House of Cards. And I wondered if that was what that experience was like for you, bringing the plane into land on two separate runways, if you will. There's your performance, but also you're bringing it into land as a director. And was there added pressure in a way for you?
So much pressure. Oh, yeah. So much pressure. And it was, you know, it was the end. So it was bittersweet. And I think that last day, at the last scene of the last day of season six, was where I kill Stamper with the letter opener. And we weren't making our day. We were going overtime, because we had so many scenes to shoot in our last day. We did not have an extra day on the calendar. We were going to lose all the actors, blah, blah, blah. And I think we shot until midnight, 1 o'clock, where normally you'd wrap by, you know, 6, 8 p.m. We just kept shooting to get that scene. And then they had a disco ball in the Oval Office set, turned on the disco ball, popped champagne, and we all cried and hugged each other goodbye. And it was, you know, that's a family. That's a 6-year, very bonded relationship. You see those people more than you see your family.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you're on a series like that.
Every shoot should end with a disco ball being dropped from the ceiling, I think.
I'm advocating for that across the board.
How did things wrap up on Damsel? Was it very much okay? Robin Wright's wrapped now. No disco ball. That's it. Sorry, we're out.
No disco ball. It was just like cut. Get back. Okay, go. Moving on, friend.
And just real quick, because I have to let you go. On this is a reunion of sorts with Ray Winston, who you worked with on Beowulf. But I spoke to Ray. I had the great pleasure of speaking to Ray a couple of weeks ago, and he was waxing lyrical about his Beowulf experience as well. What are your memories of that? You've obviously had the Robert Zemeckis, I'm calling him Robert now, the Robert Zemeckis live action and motion capture animation experience as well. What was that like for you?
A few times.
Yeah.
Ray's just classic, and I remember being I'm not starstruck ever. I was a little bit starstruck with him because Sexy Beast is truly one of my favorite movies of all time.
It's such a great movie.
It's so good. Call me from Aphra. He did. Call me from Aphra. No. Just so many great lines.
So many great lines. Lines we probably could, but probably shouldn't repeat on a podcast, but...
Nope, that was about the extent of what we could say is what I just said, right?
Well, you can say, you can go, no, yes, Grosvenor, yes, you can do that. But that's pretty much it. Robin Wright, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, and best luck with everything for the future.
Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye.
This week's episode of the Empire Podcast is brought to you in association with the M&M's Short Film Festival, a particularly sweet opportunity for budding filmmakers to get their own short film made. The M&M's Short Film Festival is an initiative to support the next generation of filmmaking talent, and it gives aspiring directors a dedicated platform to showcase their work, no matter their background. M&M's is committed to increasing diversity in filmmaking, and to that end, the competition for their short film festival opened in December of last year, receiving loads of entrants, all of whom pitched their idea for a short film based on the theme of belonging. The entrants were whittled down to a final three who went head-to-head in an epic 72-hour hackathon to create a short trailer showcasing the concept for their short films. And now, this is where you guys come in. All three of the trailers are now available to view in full over on the M&M's Short Film Festival website, mms.com/shortfilmfestival. And there you can vote for the entrant that you deem best. And the maker of that will receive a cash prize of £25,000 to fund their short film, as well as expert mentorship to help in its creation. So, what are you waiting for? Head over once again to mms.com/shortfilmfestival to see the finalist trailers and have your say in which one would go on to see their dream realized. And now, back to the show. Okay, that was Robin Wright. We'll be talking about Damsel later on in the show. Now it's time for the movie news section.
Mm.
So, not a lot of movie news out this week. So, Wendell Pierce, aka Bunk in The Wire, has been cast as Perry White in James Gunn's Superman. That's exciting. That's good. That's good really casting. Good.
Yep.
That is good casting. I do love Wendell Pierce.
Yes. He is fantastic. And,
but you know what else?
What's that?
I feel like Apple TV Plus is now trolling me because they are now making not one, but two documentaries about Steve Martin, which will be out later this month, and which I'm going to be almost obligated to review on the Pilot TV podcast, and just kill me.
Why? The scales are going to fall from your eyes, and you're going to realize he's fucking funny.
Am
he's
I amazing.
Yes,
he's brilliant. One of the funniest men. No, in fairness, James probably feels about Steve Martin the way I feel about Charlie Chaplin. But
oh boy.
And that no, nothing will convince him. Nothing. You could show him The Man with Two Brains, yeah, and it wouldn't be a flicker.
But he plays Dr. Huffer.
Dr. Harfar, Dr. Michael Harfar, and it's pronounced like it's spelled.
Yeah. I just, it's
they
not funny.
Cook her nines into the mud, scum queen.
No.
He's the pioneer of the screw top method. No, absolutely of brain not surgery. No,
no.
Nothing.
No.
He asks his dead wife's portrait whether she's upset with him.
But could seeing someone else, sign,
give him a sign.
Give him a sign if he shouldn't see this other woman.
And the painting starts spinning around and the lights start going off and then you hear a spectral voice going, no! And then he goes, anything. I'll be waiting for your sign. No? Nothing? Anyway, why would you review these in the pilot podcast? Aren't these films?
Well, no, it's a two-part documentary.
It could still be a film.
Well, Boydie would argue that it is a two-part TV event as opposed to a film.
Well, he's wrong. He's very wrong.
Regularly, yes, in that I case, agree.
You should review Damsel on the Pilot TV podcast. You know what? I hereby banish Lee from reviewing Steve, all caps, brackets,
Steve.
Martin.
Exclamation mark.
Exclamation mark on
Steve.
The
please ban me. Please ban me. I covet
it's gonna be great. There's gonna be so much banjo playing. You're gonna love it.
He's a good banjo player.
He's a really good banjo player.
That run, the early run, The Jerk, Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, All of Me, in which he plays a lawyer whose body or one half of his body is possessed by the spirit of Lily Tomlin, some of the greatest physical comedy you will ever see. And then the Man with Two Brains, all Carl Reiner movies. Phenomenal. One of the greatest runs for any movie comedian ever. And I'm including Charlie motherfucking Chaplin in that.
Jesus.
And then, you know, so many other great films as well. Roxanne.
Great film.
Cheaper by the Dozen. And so many other great
Three
movies.
Amigos.
Bowfinger. Three Amigos. My God. Come on, man. What's wrong with
you? I wanted
you?
To like a lot more than I did because it's got Eddie Murphy in it, but alas, I did not enjoy it.
Oh, you're just a monster. Anyway, moving along.
Dear God. Yes. Anyway, I'm excited about that because I'm a big fan of Steve Martin because he's one of the funniest people of all.
Well, you should review it on the Pilot TV podcast.
I should. Anything else to talk about before we talk about the Oscars?
There's a little bit of Karate Kid news. So ooh, Joshua Jackson joined this week, as did Ming-Na Wen.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
this
exciting.
Is along with Jackie Chan. Ben Wang is, I think, the actual Karate Kid in this one. But Jackie Chan is Mr. Han again after playing him in the 2010 remake. And Ralph Macchio's in it. So it's it's shaping up to be fun.
This is like the two universes colliding.
Colliding.
The seven worlds will collide. Oh,
so happy about it. But it sounds really cool. I think it'll be fun.
Yeah, it's exciting. Rebecca Ferguson to star opposite Chris Pratt in a thriller for Amazon Studios called Mercy. Reggie Sean Page to star in Black Bag for Steven Soderbergh, opposite Michael Fassbender and Kate Blanchett. Very, very good indeed. And also well done to Dune Part 2 for making lots of money. Oscars. So we were at one point trying to find the time to do an Oscars preview special. We were unable to find that time. So we're going to try and cram it in the next 10, 15 minutes or so. We're going to go category by category as best as we can. Let's start off with the big one. Best live action short? No. Let's start with the doubt that we should say, of course, that we're doing this because the Oscars are on Sunday.
Yes.
The Oscars are on Sunday. We're not just randomly doing it. It's because they're on Sunday at the Dolby Theatre in Hollywood, Los Angeles, hosted by Jimmy Kimmel, who apparently is hosting for the fourth time. I do not remember him hosting more than once.
He hasn't been bad. He's been fine.
In fairness, I tend to miss it now.
Yeah, he's a safe pair of hands, I think. I've just watched the intros.
And they're on ITV, so anyone can watch them.
Hurrah.
Yes.
So, so the nominees for adapted screenplay, American Fiction, Barbie, Oppenheimer, Poor Things, and The Zone of Interest.
Yes.
I know there was some outrage about Barbie being adapted, but the fact is that the character of the doll...
I hate that technicality in this category. I mean, it really annoys me.
I don't have strong feelings about it.
It's a bit, it makes no sense.
It's why sequels are always adapted.
Oh, it's just bullshit.
You've already come up with the character.
I know, but still, it's annoying. I mean, it's not going to win either way, so...
Yeah, it's not going to win, no. So what do you think is going to win? Is it going to be...
I think it's Cord Jefferson.
Cord Jefferson for American Fiction?
Yeah.
That's a great adaptation.
Yes.
Yeah.
Having read Erasure by Percival Everett and then seen American Fiction, actually I did it the other way around, that is an extraordinary adaptation. Yeah. The stuff that Cord Jefferson has taken from that, the changes he has made to that story to retain a kind of dark edge to the film, but to remove, quite frankly, stuff that would have been an absolute bummer, is really, really interesting.
But the question is, how much do Oscar voters know that? Because, like, realistically, they'll watch the film, we hope, but I very much doubt they read the source material.
They might have watched the documentary or the interview about it.
Mm.
You'd really hope.
But The Zone of Interest is a real contender in this category. It has won on several occasions. And it has the kind of weight of being an incredibly good film, a very serious subject matter behind it, which can help. And the other thing is, I think it's probably going to win Best International Feature, although that's, again, a pretty freaking strong category. But that's the one that's probably ahead. Like, Anatomy of a Fall isn't in there, which is perhaps a surprise. And so it's probably the forerunner in that category. And that might also boost it in the adapted screenplay category.
Possibly. So, okay. Money where your mouth is, time.
I think Zone of Interest.
Zone of Interest. James, American Fiction?
American Fiction, yes. I'm sticking with that.
I think that's Oppenheimer.
All right.
I think it'll be Oppenheimer. Best Original Screenplay, Anatomy of a Fall, The Holdovers, Maestro, May, December, Past Lives.
I mean, I think Past Lives is extraordinary, but I think it's going to be The Holdovers.
This is difficult. I want it to be Past Lives. Could be Holdovers. Could be Anatomy of a Fall. I reckon it's one of those two.
Yep. It'll be definitely one of the five. Definitely one of the five.
Yeah. Thanks.
I think it's going to be Holdovers as well. All right. Let's move on. We're not going to do every category. You'll be delighted to know. We're going to do Best Supporting Actress next. So Emily Blunt for Oppenheimer, Danielle Brooks for The Color Purple, America Ferrara for Barbie, Jodie Foster, first nomination in years for Naiad.
And Naiad in the Force.
Divine Joy Randolph.
I mean,
for The Holdovers.
It's her, isn't it?
It's her. Yeah. She's won everything this Oscar season.
She has won everything, but can a surprise be sprung, or should the other four not even bother turning up?
No, they should absolutely turn up, and they should all
all clap.
No, they should all get together before the ceremony and agree that whoever wins is going to buy dinner for the rest of them and make sure that Devine is ready for that.
We're all on the same page on that one. Best Supporting Actor, Sterling K. Brown for American Fiction, Robert De Niro for Killers of the Flower Moon, Robert Downey Jr. for Oppenheimer, but really for Captain America Civil War, Ryan Gosling for Barbie, but really The Gray Man, and then Mark Ruffalo for Poor Things, but really the first episode of She-Hulk.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, and today in untenable opinions, our guest is Chris Hewitt.
I am no word of lying wearing Marvel boxer shorts today. Oh, no. And they just got a little tighter. Anyway. What? No, as in, I didn't.
No, it was, please stop.
It wasn't.
Anyway,
so anyway,
Robert Downey Jr. Okay. will, I suspect, win this one. I think that, you know, Sterling K. Brown was really, really good. And I vaguely recall from the nightmare fever dream that was Killers of the Flower Moon that Robert De Niro was very good. But nevertheless, I think this is Downey's.
It is Downey's. But I have, you know, I have loved what Ryan Gosling did as Ken for, you know, nearly a
we
year
called
now.
It, if you go back and listen to The Empire. Supporting special for Barbie, we said, you know, America Ferrera deserves an Oscar nomination. Ryan Gosling's going to be nominated. We thought Margot Robbie should be nominated,
She should have been. But like, I think he's magnificent as Ken, and I think it should be a closer race than it is. But I'm not going to begrudge Robert Downey Jr. because I think he did very good work in that.
Absolutely, film. And I think if you're Oscar voters at the moment, you know, the Oppenheimer Express seems pretty damned unstoppable.
Choo-choo.
And then imagine that you're going to all these luncheons and functions and things, and then the charisma machine that is Robert Downey Jr. comes at you, you know, not in that way, not in the sex way, and just turns it on.
Mm.
And if you were already thinking, oh, I really liked him, and I really liked that performance, and oh my God, I just met Robert Downey Jr. and he was amazing.
I'm not sure there's that much glad. I'm not sure that glad handing plays that much of a role these days. I think a lot of people do it remotely now, and there's literally thousands of voters.
Mm.
Even Robert Downey Jr. would struggle to get around all of them. But
yes, he'll get you eventually. But you know, but not to say that Ryan Gosling hasn't been putting on the charm either. Very charming man, lovely,
very
hair.
Charming man, lovely,
lovely,
hair.
Lovely hair.
But I don't think that's the question.
All right, I think it will be Downey. I'd be very, very happy to see Tony Stark win an Oscar. It'd be very, very cool. I wouldn't be sad if it was Ryan Gosling either.
Neither would I.
No.
But this is the
weird thing about this year. Almost all the categories, you're like, I'm happy with these guys. I'm not going to, you know, be up in arms.
There's no one
I'm not furious
there's
about
no, anyone. Yeah, no. There's no sort of La La Lands here or whatever.
Hey, come
name
on
Name your
now.
Personal
come
beef.
On.
Come on.
There's no crashes here then. Fine. We can all agree on crash, right? There is no crash here that we're going to be, you know, upset about winning.
Agreed.
Best actress, Annette Bening for Captain Marvel, Lily Gladstone for Killers of the Flower Moon, Sandra Hüller for Anatomy of a Fall, Annette Bening's for Naiad, Carey Mulligan for Maestro, and Emma Stone for Poor Things, but really, The Amazing Spider-Man 2.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
I mean, as we have said, and as we said on the live show last night, I think like part of us wants this to be Emma Stone's, but it's going to be Lily Gladstone.
I'm not so sure.
It's going to go to a stone.
I'm not so sure. It will go to a stone of some kind, unless Annette Bening swoops in. I don't know. As I have seen mooted, because obviously of the preferential ballot type way that the Oscars are voted for, there is a potential that, you know, you could have a Lily Gladstone, Emma Stone vote split, and then a real trooper like Annette Bening comes in and nabs the Oscar. Could happen.
In an infinite universe, all things are possible. However...
I don't know. I think I would not be surprised if I wake up on Monday morning, because I am absolutely not watching this, to see Emma Stone to see Twitter furious because Emma Stone has won this.
I would be surprised. Mm-hmm. Not angry, but I would be surprised.
I'd be very happy, but also, you know, surprised, yes.
Yeah, all right.
As Helen says, the narrative just isn't going that way, so...
It'll probably be Lily Gladstone, but I'm just saying, it might be Emma Stone.
And she'll have fabulous earrings. Her earrings game has been just off the charts all award season.
Does she give the best performance, though?
No, I think Sandra Hüller in Anatomy of a Fall is off the charts. But Emma Stone as Bella Baxter, I think, is one for the ages. I think that is an incredible performance.
Significantly more furious jumping in that performance than
there is, yes, but I'm not sure that's what puts it over the top, even though you would expect the jumping to have helped. I think, if anything, the furious jumping has probably hurt her chances. But And yeah. and arguably, Furious Jumping also played a role in The Nightmare Before. Am I right?
Hey, come on now. Come on now. If you haven't seen Poor Things, by the way, it is on Disney Plus as of today when we're recording this on Thursday. Yeah, it just hit Disney Plus. So check it out because it's going to win a whole bunch of Oscars. Most of them technical, but you never know.
You never know.
You never know. Best Actor, Bradley Cooper for Maestro as Leonard Bernstein. Colman Domingo for Rustin as Bayard Rustin. Paul Giamatti for The Holdovers as I'm doing it. Paul Hunham. Cillian Murphy for Oppenheimer as J. Robert Oppenheimer. And Jeffrey Wright for American Fiction as the loneliest, air quote, monk. Why have we gone David Lynch? Close air quotes. Ellison. There we go.
So I think the narrative before award season really got going was that, oh, this could be Bradley Cooper's year. Ooh. And then it's just been pretty much Cillian Murphy the whole way. Yes, with an occasional swerve into Paul Giamatti.
I don't think we can entirely take off them swerving into Paul Giamatti as a possibility.
I've never swerved off a possibility in my life. I've never said a possibility isn't possible. My point is, I don't think it's likely.
But you know what? You know what I want.
What do you want?
You know, to have a good night's sleep as well on Sunday. But I want to wake up to find a surprise. I want to wake up and go, oh, I didn't see that coming. Because I think because of the sheer weight of Guild Awards and different awards and different luncheons and galas and things like that, for the longest time, we tend to know going into the Oscars 99% of the big winners. Like, you know, there are people who will be going to that ceremony on Sunday night just to have a great time, and they will have had no expectation whatsoever of winning. Because if you're Kerry Mulligan, you're great in Maestro, but you know you're not going to win.
Yeah.
Right? If you're Bradley Cooper, great in Maestro, you know you're not going to win. But what if?
It was just
a surprise.
I know. And well, then you end up like Pedro Pascal the other week at the, was it SAG Awards? Having to go up on stage drunk because he was like pretty sure he wasn't going to win. So he just started hitting the drink and then had to try
and then give away spoilers to The Mandalorian and Grogu and The Fantastic Four at the same time. And by the way,
well, not that I noticed, but that would have been fun. So, I think a lot of people have said actually one of the best things you can do is go along to an award show where you know you're pretty sure you're not going to win. And just have a nice time.
Great time. Anyway, so it's going to be Cillian Murphy?
I think it's likely to be Cillian Murphy. I'm not discounting the possibility of a Paul Giamatti, but
Paul Giamatti. All right, so Best Director is going to be one of Justin Triet for Anatomy of a Fall, Martin Scorsese for Killers of the Flower Moon, Christopher Nolan, bing, 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 for Oppenheimer. What? That was a strange noise. Where did that come
so
from?
Weird.
Yorgos Lanthimos. No, bing, 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 bing noise for that. Oh, weird.
Strange.
For Poor Things. And Jonathan Glazer? Nope. For The Zone of Interest. But there was a weird noise when I said Christopher Nolan.
It's almost like that's almost as nailed on as it gets.
As nailed on as it gets. He will come pre-Oscar. They should just give him the Oscar when he turns up on the red carpet going, here you go. Just have it.
Yeah, just
get
have
used
it.
To it. Get used to the weight.
Can you imagine the expression on his face if he doesn't win?
Oh, that would be an all-timer. An Oscar clip, in fairness.
That'll be a meme for the ages.
Yeah, it really would be. But we do not wish to see it because we want him to win. British cinema. You wake up and you watch those news programs and they go, the Brits have done well this year at the Oscars. And then there will be absolutely a TV show that claims Cillian Murphy is a Brit. I know it's going to happen. Yeah. Cillian Murphy has won Best Actor for Oppenheimer. It's a great day for Britain, everybody.
And then they'll hurriedly add in Ireland in the edit.
Yeah. But it'll be Nolan. The best success by Nolan at an awards ceremony since the Eurovision Song Contest. that's what I'm going to say. It's him. Best Picture. It's Oppenheimer. I know.
It is. Don't even miss the others.
American Fiction, Anatomy of a Fall, Barbie, The Holdovers, Killers of the Flower Moon, Maestro, Past Lives, Poor Things, The Zone of Interest, Your Boys Took a Hell of a Beating. It will always be Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
Oscarheimer. It's happening.
Yeah, it does seem that way. We didn't mention Best Animated Feature, but do you think there's any scenario where the absolutely beautiful Robot Dreams or the incredible Spider-Verse beats The Boy and the Heron?
No. And I'm sad about that.
I'm really sad about Nimona. Fuck you all.
Nimona's a great look. It's a really good film. Elemental, I think, is the weak link in that category. Yeah, so do I. But
oh, that's a good film.
It's fun.
It was a great year for animation.
This was a much better film, strong
year for animation as I can remember.
Yeah.
Because you have films in there that weren't even nominated. Puss in Boots, The Last Wish, incredible film.
Great film.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Mutant Mayhem. Really good film. Wasn't even nominated. I find it, yeah, I think the Miyazaki wave of love and adulation will get that film, The Boy and the Heron, over the line. I'm a little sad that Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse has tailed off the way it has.
Yeah, me too.
Because it's one of the year's best films. It's a phenomenal sequel. It maybe didn't quite push the envelope or wasn't perceived to have pushed the envelope in the way that the first one did. But the greatest Oscar snub, apart from obviously Wonka not getting anything, is Daniel Pemberton not being nominated for his Spider-Verse score, which is just ludicrous.
Bananas.
Absolutely ludicrous. But I would have thought it was nailed on to win best animated film, and then
The Boy and the Heron
Miyazaki-san came out of retirement and all bets were off. But it is a little sad because I genuinely thought that might be one of those animated movies that might even have been able to gatecrash the rest of the conversation.
Yeah, I think it should have been certainly up for score, and we didn't mention score, but we think that's Oppenheimer as well.
Yeah,
probably.
Yeah, again because of the exclusion of Daniel Pemberton.
Yeah.
And Michael Giacchino for Society of the Snow, which is a great score. But anyway,
we
have banged on about the Oscars enough. It's going to be on Sunday night. I will watch part of it and then I'll get very tired. I can't do all-nighters the way I used to be able to. I hope it goes well for everybody. If you're listening to this and you're attending, I hope you have a great time. And I hope that you bring back Little Gold Boy. And man, you know, poor things, Nadia Stacey, another triumph for Britain.
Oh yeah, seriously.
Yeah, well done. The Brits have won the Oscars yet again. The British are coming, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Second guest time?
Let's do it.
Second guest time. This hasn't happened yet, so there's a chance it may not have happened. But hopefully it will happen. The Wonder Wise,
we hold on with tears in our eyes.
Sorry.
You can't help it, can you?
I can't help it.
You could try, though.
I don't want to try. If I tried, I wouldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then everyone would lose out. Oh, such a great song. Curtis Tigers. And DeWanda Wise, of course, was the star, one of the stars of Jurassic World Dominion. And now she is the star of Imaginary, Jeff Wadlow's Blumhouse horror film about an imaginary friend who turns out to be not so imaginary or indeed so friendly. So, haven't done the interview yet. It's happening in a few hours' time. I hope it goes well. I hear she's lovely. So, fingers crossed.
Awesome.
Here is The Wonder Wise. Enjoy.
We are delighted to be joined on the Emperor podcast by the star of Imaginary, although I think she's pretty real, DeWanda Wise.
Up for debate. Thanks for having me.
What is real? What is imaginary? Are you real? Am I real? What's going on?
We don't know. It's 2024. You know, any of us could just be a bot. All of us are just bots floating through space.
That's terrifying, isn't it? Because whenever the pandemic happened and people started doing interviews on Zoom, I always just assumed it would be the person doing it. But now you're absolutely right. You could be AI.
Deepfake.
Oh my God.
Yep. Correct.
That's terrifying.
It's
oh my God, you could be manipulated into saying anything at all. This is, meanwhile, the real DeWanda Wise is on the beach.
It cracks me up. You know, that does not, for whatever reason, I'm mischievous enough that amuses me instead of terrifies me. It's pretty funny to me.
Excellent stuff. Okay, let's go with that. Let's go with that rather than the terrifying realities of it all. But yeah, so Imaginary itself, you are also an executive producer on this. Now,
that was correct.
Can you talk me through what that means? Were you there to crack the whip in terms of budget every day? Were you making sure? Because I know a Blumhouse film is a tight ship.
Yes, it is a tight ship. I think, from inception, that's so funny. In terms of being able to make a movie at a price, you know, the first thing that the director, Jeff Wadlow, asked me, you know, I read the script, I met with him, and he was like, you know, this isn't Jurassic World, you know what I mean? The implication being, you know, don't expect someone making your meals just because you need to maintain your muscles, which I did have. Thank you, Universal, for that. But you know, I as I said to Jeff, you know, if you dig in the resume a little bit, you just see a lot of indies, you see a lot of indie shorts. So, you know, I consider myself as much a filmmaker as I do an actor. You know, I know how to make a movie and how to be resourceful doing so. So with Jeff, who also trained as a producer, I didn't really have to crack the whip. I just got to play, thankfully, you know, and got to be on all the emails and in all the Zooms when all the choices are being made, which is a lot of fun. If you're into that kind of thing, you know, I could imagine that there were facets of production and facets of it that Jeff was just like, I don't know. And I don't, he was like, I mean, I care. So I won't say that Jeff didn't care, but you know, he didn't have a strong opinion about outfits, for example, you know what I mean? Like he wasn't like, I really need Jessica to wear this yellow dress. That was definitely me. He was definitely apprehensive about having his protagonist in a dress in the last third of this movie. But it worked out and no one was injured. So.
Let's dig into that. And then I want to talk about the Blumhouse approach to making films as well. Because the yellow dress is really striking as well, because I imagine Jeff was slightly nervous, what, because of all the running and jumping and whatnot that Jessica does in the movie?
Correct.
Okay, okay. And you were totally fine. So you were
I was totally fine. I had this imagery in my head, this sort of like mashup between Bruce Willis at the end of Die Hard and, you know, that scene from Carrie where she's just like drenched in blood. Yes. And I was like, no, there's nothing more powerful than destroying a dress. It just looks really cool.
And so you chose this dress? You were the architect of this dress? Can you talk me through that?
I'm not the architect of this dress. I sent Yulin, our costume designer, Jessica's like mood board, you know, which was both color and vibe. And, you know, and from that mood board, we came to just the warmer tones. You know, they really complement this chocolate skin, and which I've always known. The yellow dress was an option, and we needed one that was had a lot of duplicates. There are like 10 versions, obviously, because you have to destroy it and also have a pristine version. So she found it. And it was just clear. I was just like, I saw it on the rack and I was like, that one, I don't know what you intend to use that for, but it's definitely our, they call it a hero outfit. Like if there's ever an outfit, I'm sure you know, expert that you are.
Oh, thank you. Come on.
But yeah, choosing the hero outfit is a real thing. It's also why, you know, you see Tegan in that cut off black tank top and the ripped blue jeans. That is the hero's uniform, you know?
Yellow dress aside, can you talk me through a moment or an instant on this film where best idea won for you?
There's always something that a director is going to be really, really fixated on. And ours was the art. You know, there's all these, there are many sequences with Jessica, you know, in the studio or, you know, there's this beautiful moment where they're building. I don't think this is a spoiler, but they're like, they have to build a door. And he was really, really nervous about it. And so I really just did my best to continue to work with our art department and our props department. And obviously, you know, I'm the nerdiest actor and nerdiest preparer of all time. So, even before we started production, I was already like brushing up on, you know, my visual artist skill set, which I'd already had from She's Gotta Have It. But yeah, I'd say that was something that I really kind of took ownership and charge of throughout the course of production.
And with this character as well, with Jessica, can you talk me through how you approached her, knowing that this is a movie, there's going to be a lot of buzz around Chauncey, around the bear. There's going to be a lot of focus on that in the marketing. And
I didn't know that.
Okay. Well, that's interesting.
You said, how do you approach a character knowing that? I would like you, Chris, to know that I did not know that. And we got to marketing and I was like, oh, right. We got to make this is a horror movie. We got to make this bear a star. Yeah. That's crazy. No one was, that was not a thought that went into, you know, I'm not making a movie thinking about the marketing, much to my manager's chagrin.
But it's interesting because obviously sometimes in a movie like this, a horror film like this, where there is such a strong villain, so to speak, you know, how do you make sure that your character, Jessica, stands out?
I don't. It's embarrassing to say. I mean, I will say I entered Jurassic with a certain level of security and like peace, because I was just like, the dinosaurs are the stars. Like, I really was. I was like, they don't care about us. Like, it doesn't even, I just get to go over here and play and do my thing and be as truthful as possible. And the real deal is my approach as an actor, there's no performance modulation. There's no, oh, now I'm acting for a blockbuster. Oh, now I'm like horror movie acting. There's no modulation. What I knew I could bring to Jessica, and also what I knew that I could bring as a producer to every performance in this movie. You know, I was on performance watch for every single actor in this movie. I was literally with all of them, like, don't worry, I got your back. I will not let you look dumb in this movie. You know, there will be no Razzies. There will be no Razzie nominations.
Good. Okay. Good.
There was some traps. This movie has some traps. You know, we have an addicted character. We have a dad with dementia. Yeah. We have the exposition crazy neighbor lady. Like, there was some landmines. We
yes.
had a teenage trope. You know what I mean? So I walked in not only for myself knowing how to protect my own performance and characterization, but also how to protect my fellow castmates as well.
You said you were the nerdiest actor going. So what do you mean by that?
It means that, you know, only in recent years have I actually began sharing my process with directors. But, you know, from day one, man, literally from day one, you know, back in high school, my drama teacher gave me one of those long form, multi-page, like how to build a character, all the questions, literally all the questions, everything you can think of biologically, favorites, you know, to how they move, how they carry themselves. I play around with tone a lot. That's why Jessica does not sound like this, because that's not how Jessica sounds. So it's my secret sauce. It's why I've been fortunate enough, I feel, and hopefully it will continue, because I'm not that cocky. It's why I've been fortunate enough to have characters that people, you know, identify with and latch onto, because I really do my utmost to make sure that they are actual human beings and not, you know, two-dimensional people moving through a demonic teddy bear movie.
Is that how it was pitched to you, by the way? A demonic teddy bear movie?
No one pitched it. My team knows better than to pitch me anything. They don't try to sell me on anything. They're like, just send DeWanda the script. It's like, it's wasted breath. They like, just send her the script. Doesn't matter what we say. I'm a very long suffering used to me saying no team, Chris.
So if someone had said to you, for example, because you get the script then for Imaginary, mm-hmm. and you're reading it and you're going, okay, page 10, I'm in. Page 20, I'm in. Page 30, I'm definitely in. But if someone had said to you, DeWanda, this is a demonic teddy bear movie, you'd have gone, absolutely not, get the hell out of here. Is that what That's you would hilarious. Have done?
No, I think I probably would have read it. And, you know, part of my toxic villain story, my toxic trait is I'm chronically telling... I get this a lot. There's so many journalists who point out that they'll be the movie that exists and then they'll be the movie that I'm in. So for me, I read Imaginary and I think thematically it's about how terrifying it is to face your own shit. For me, Imaginary is about how absolutely terrifying it is to face your own demons and deal with your own trauma. For everyone else, it's a demonic teddy bear movie, and I'm happy about that. And please come and laugh and be scared, you know? But if you cry in the movie theaters, just know that that is not surprising to me, okay?
Job
if you
done.
Find yourself calling your father after you see this movie, just know that that was my intention.
I believe the tagline is just when you thought it was safe to call your parents. Imaginary.
Well, but you know, if you try to market this movie the way that I would market it, you'd be like, okay, no one would go, first of all.
But it is about facing your trauma. It is about, you know, getting in touch with your fears again. And I'm imagining that is something that you confronted as you began to dig into this character and into this process.
Yeah, I think I would like to think that I, you know, have, you know, me and my therapist are in a timeout. So I like to think that I'm at a relatively healthy place. But the prospect of honestly, even simply acknowledging that there are kids who have a really tough way to go, you know, just have a really tough way to go. You know, it's not easy for everyone. We have a certain construct of childhood where, you know, it's like, oh my goodness, I miss being a kid. I didn't have any bills to pay. Like you hear that a lot.
Yeah.
You just hear that so much where people are like, oh my goodness, my innocent childhood. And that's not, you know, childhood isn't a safe time for many kids. You know, it wasn't the safest time for me. So reading this on the page and even seeing a character like Alice played by Piper Braun and then finding a kid who can embody that, you know, it's just a little something that I just thought was really honestly beautiful in a way.
But Piper's amazing in this. And
incredible.
They say never work with children or animals.
I don't know why they say that. I love working with children.
How about animatronic animals? Do you like working with those?
It's so funny. So we had a lot of puppeteers. So there were bodies on set. And there's nothing funnier than seeing a dude like, you know, slide across the floor in a suit. Like there's just nothing. It's just funny. It's hilarious. Like working on creature features. First of all, I felt like I was in the 1950s or 80s. Choose your pick. You know what I mean? but something about seeing, you know, these creatures like go to the craft service table for a snack. It's funny. Working on horror movies is hilarious.
So when you say they're dressed in suits, are they dressed in the kind of the green leotards that we've seen? So they could be...
No. What you see in the movie is what they're wearing.
Oh my God. Right.
Ours was, yeah, there were all those, all of the things were built by Spectral, which is like a monster house. Chauncey was there obviously, but then also like, you know, all the creatures, I will say, that you see in this film were there on set with us. So shout out to creature performer Michael, who plays two of them and was just absolutely like some of his physical work in this film is just, it was just extraordinary. It's insane.
And then do you keep your distance from him when you're on set or are you hanging out at craft services together?
No, we're hanging out. We're definitely hanging out. We're definitely hanging out. I'm like, I need to know everything. Tell me everything. Did you stretch this morning? You know what I mean?
Have you stopped stretching? I assume you're stretching right now. It's just constant stretching with those guys.
Exactly. Like also, I will give a plug right now because Dane is so tall. He's a former, he plays the large, large, large monster
okay.
in our movie. And if somebody doesn't cast this man to play a regular human being, this man wants to play a regular human being so badly. If y'all don't cast him as a handyman or a lawyer, you know, and I have a solution. Just find a tall cast. That's it. Just find a really tall cast. Call up Elizabeth DeBecky. And it'll be great.
How tall is he in real life?
Like 8 feet tall.
Holy shit. It's very tall. It's very tall.
It's very tall. So he is in creature player purgatory. And I'm like, you know what, man? We're going to figure it out. Because that's what I do. That's what EP DeWanda does. So we're going to work it out.
How about this? It's a lawyer, but we only ever see him sitting down. Like, he's quite cool. He's quite casual about stuff. So instead of, you know, when you see courtroom dramas and they go, Your Honor, I object, and they stand up and they're all indignant. This guy's just like, hey, Your Honor. He's just like, oh, whatever. And he just stays seated.
Resourceful. Solutions oriented.
There you go. I am available. Should Blumhouse wish to call me? I am absolutely 100% ready to make that leap.
Ready.
I'm ready to make that leap. I wanted to ask you, I mentioned craft services. What's the craft services like on a Blumhouse production? Here's how I imagine it. I imagine it's like most other craft services, but Jason Blum is standing nearby. And if you go reach in, he slaps your hand and goes, no, one breadstick. One.
Here is something that I think is very important for anybody who is looking to work with Jason Blum. This is very important. So hear me out right now. That man might be frugal, but he knows that the heart of any crew's happiness is the food. The catering was the best catering I have ever had on any job ever. He's smart. He knows where to spend his money. He knows where to spend his money, the catering. It's, this is the first job I worked on where I gained weight.
Wow.
First one. We had to resize these jeans. I was like, who was she? I don't know who she was, but she is gone. So you need to let these pants out.
That's amazing. So even better than the catering on Jurassic World, where you like had your own chefs and stuff?
Listen, I love Chef Jamie, but I mean, also I was on a very boring keep these muscles diet. So It's hard to prepare. I wasn't trying to create a soft and fragile body like I was for Jessica.
Here, DeWanda, here's a whole chicken. Just eat that. Go and have that. Yeah.
It was pretty simple, pretty basic.
And you know, I'm going to say this very, very quickly as well, because regular listeners of the podcast will know this. Do you know, are you aware of course you are, but I'm just going to say it anyway, the Curtis Steiger's hit, I Wonder Why?
I am.
I have a thing where I sing that song when I'm talking about you on the podcast, but I put your name in instead of I Wonder Why.
That's hilarious, and I love that for me.
I needed to tell you that, because if I didn't tell you that, I would have been accused of cowardice. Because it just fits so perfectly. And the wonder why's we hold on. You know, tears in our eyes. And the wonder why's we have to break down. You know, it just fits.
It just fits. Also, what a lovely voice, Chris.
Oh, the wonder you come on.
You're behind the comedy. I'll hear it.
I've got a cold. That's what it is. That's what it is. I was terrified I would mortally offend you, and I probably have, but I had to tell you, I had to share it. I had to share.
No, I, if not, obviously have a very healthy sense of humor. So
that's what made me think, you know what? It's okay. It's going to be okay.
It's more than okay.
We'll get through this together. Absolutely. DeWanda Wise, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much indeed.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Take care.
All right. That was DeWanda Wise. We hold on with tears in our eyes. Oh, such a great song.
It's not a great song. It's more the way you sing it, really.
Well, I sing it spot on. Mm. It's like Curtis Steiger himself was in the room. He actually does a show on Chaz FM. There's a good chance Curtis Steiger has been in this very studio.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway. We have not seen Imaginary for review purposes. So we will not be talking about Imaginary. We might talk about it the next week's show. And I don't know what we've given it.
Okay.
So we're not going to start off the reviews portion of the show with Imaginary, but we are going to start off with Damsel.
All right.
Yes. We're going to start off with Damsel, which is Juan Carlos Fresnadillo's fantasy movie, as we've explained already, about Millie Bobby Brown trying to survive a scrape with a dragon. Hell's bells. Mm.
Yeah, Millie Bobby Brown, Elodie, as her character goes by. Her parents are played by Ray Winston, and her stepmother is played by Angela Bassett.
Yeah.
Personally, if I were Angela Bassett, I would demand more to do than Angela Bassett has in this film, but maybe she just fancied a nice holiday in Portugal where this was shot.
Was it? Because yes. A lot of it looks like it was shot on in green screen land.
Okay, some of it was shot here in London in green screen land. The point is, she goes off to marry a prince, and then wouldn't you know it, she gets fed to a dragon instead. We've all been there, very relatable. It's the classic, you know, fail to notice the red flags of his mother being a total bitch, and you might end up fed to a giant, hungry, probably reptile, it's hard to say. The point is, she then has to really go on a sort of internal and external journey of learning how to survive, how to toughen up, and how to face this new predicament. A series of new predicaments, really, in which she finds herself, and I think it's a pretty good tour de force, I think, for Millie Bobby Brown. I think, you know, she gets a lot to do, both physically and sort of mentally, and, you know, in terms of acting in this film. It is, however, and I really want to make this clear, a fucking weird film. It's very strange, because it is really quite scary. It's quite horror-y at times. It's not just you might think, oh, look, the star of Enola Holmes is in a fantasy movie. You know, you're thinking, oh, Ellen, she's
perky,
maybe
perky,
fun.
Princess Bridie. They've got Robin Wright in this for a reason.
They have Robin Wright.
But they've also got the star of Scum in this movie for a reason.
Which is maybe, and Strange Days, you know, which is maybe giving
Beast.
You more of a clue to where this is going. Because it is very deconstructed, I would say, fantasy.
Yes, but it's also Juan Carlos Fresnadillo, directed, of course, 28
days later.
Weeks later.
Yes.
28 weeks later.
So it was on set off.
I mean, that's a gnarly fucking horror film. Yes, that is proper. That doesn't.
The eyes.
It doesn't relent. So this is kind of in a wheelhouse.
It kind of is. And I think
I like that.
I think it got a PG-13 in the States, so it's not going full kind of body horror.
No.
But there was more than I was maybe expecting.
Yeah.
And the tone is quite dark compared to maybe, again, Enola Holmes or anything of that ilk. I guess if you can stand Stranger Things, you can probably stand the horror levels in this. But it's really just not what I expected it to be. And it doesn't do what I expected it to do in a number of ways. And I liked being surprised by it, but it did make the tone at times feel a little kind of, I don't know, inconsistent or all over the place. That's harsh. It's not all over the place, but
it's... You know what I liked about it?
Mm.
A lot of things, but I think I'd probably be a bit more open than you guys. But I liked the fact that, not to get into spoilers, but once you're in that cave with Elodie, you don't leave that cave with Elodie. Like, you're trapped in there. It doesn't cut away to Ray Winston and Angela Bassett. Yeah. It doesn't cut away to Robin Wright. You're in that cave, and she's trying to figure out how the hell to get out of this. And there are numerous indicators that there have been other people in her position who have not got out of this.
No,
it's ye old ready or not.
It is, yeah, and it has really dark moments to it. Like, it really does. Helen's absolutely right. The tone of it is wild, and it is unclear who it's for, because younger audiences it's not really suitable for. And I'm not sure it's sophisticated enough for older audiences. And the sort of the livery of the film, so the pageantry of the kind of royal family, feels very Disney princess. Like, it's a bit kind of like fairy tale-y. And perhaps that's a deliberate aesthetic they were going for. But for me, it made it feel very sort of like fairy tale and not real, not grounded, which kind of, for me, was slightly at odds with the tone. And also, I think unless you are Millie Bobby Brown in this film, you have fuck all to do. Like, there's no one really apart from her gets anything to do in this. It's quite thankless for, especially Angela Bassett. But do you know what? Like, we gave this 2 stars, but I quite enjoyed it. Mm. Like, I had a pretty good time with it.
I did too.
I think 2 is harsh.
Yeah. I didn't think it was bad at all. I don't think it's the most sophisticated film ever, but I think it's quite effective at what it does. And I think she was good fun in it. So yeah, I had a giggle with this.
Mm. 2 stars in for Damsel, but I'd be in the 3-star camp. It's on Netflix, so you can check it out this weekend before you watch the Oscars on ITV. So there you go. Next up, Jimbo is another film people can watch in the comfort of their own home. Sans trousers, if you wish.
As I watched
I don't
it.
Know. As I, yeah. Was I in my pants when I watched Ricky Stenicki? I don't know. But this is Ricky Stenicki. This is the new Peter Farrelly movie.
It is one half of the Farrelly brothers, Peter Farrelly, yes. And
the Oscar-winning half.
Indeed.
Of the
and this brothers. This stars Zac Efron and... 2 other friends.
Jermaine Fowler.
That's right.
And the other one.
Andrew Santino. And they're a bunch of guys who, when they were kids, they used to pull pranks. And to get out of one particularly bad prank that went wrong, they invented a kid called Ricky Stenicki. And all through their lives since then, they have blamed this fictitious character for everything that has gone wrong and placed the blame squarely on his imaginary shoulders. They want to get out of some social events, so they say, hey, we're going to go and hang out with Ricky Stenicki. Unfortunately, it all goes horribly wrong, and they end up having to hire an erotic heavy metal impersonator from Atlantic City, played by John Cena, to play Ricky Stenicki for their I believe it's his son's bris, isn't it? For one of their son's bris.
Yes.
So John Cena as Rock Hard Rod comes in and plays the role of Ricky Stenicki to get them out of this particular Ricky Stenicki wicket, if you will.
Very good.
And what I love is that they've kept a book of all the times they've used this excuse and what they've said about Ricky Stenicki.
That's dedication.
And so they now have a storybook, a script, essentially, for him to go through.
Yeah.
What they don't expect is that he will take it really seriously and really get in character.
And goes method.
And goes method.
And this is one of these things, and we discussed this in Norwich, that were this 20 years ago, this was a Jim Carrey film, 100%. Like, you can totally see Carrey playing this role. And as we said then, I think Carrey would have given it an obnoxious edge that John Cena doesn't have. John Cena is so likable in this role that even though, honestly, like on paper, I don't think this film is that good. I don't think the dialogue's great. The script's, you know, it doesn't really do a lot of heavy lifting. It's quite basic and I didn't find it particularly funny. But I do think, despite all its failings, and there are many of them, John Cena is incredible in this.
So good.
He's so likable and he's a natural comedian and he's really funny and he is this film's secret sauce. And genuinely, I was fully prepared to hate this film with the fire of a thousand suns. And I came out actually rather enjoying it purely on the basis of his performance.
He's fearless as a performer. There's a montage of Rock Hard Rod's songs.
Oh my God.
Because he has tailored classic rock songs.
Yeah. But to the theme of masturbation.
Changed the lyrics. Amended the lyrics so they mostly refer to masturbation. And he really... He goes for it hand over fist. There's no question about it. He really pumps those songs hard.
He does.
And it's very, very good. You're absolutely right about Jim Carrey. Cause, you know, you're right. This has been knocking around for a long, long time. Jeff Bushell wrote the screenplay and it was on the blacklist in 2010. So it's taken a long time to get to the big or small screen in this case. And it's interesting, if you go at the credits at the end, there are another five writers on this. So at some point, the edges have come off this a little bit because it felt to me like it never quite pushed it as hard as it could be pushed, Helen. And while I still enjoyed it, I enjoyed all the characters and I really liked them. I don't know. It felt like it wasn't quite as raunchy, rude, raucous, or another word beginning with R as it could have been. Risque, maybe.
Yeah. I think it was, I mean, personally, it was a level of raunch that I was fine with. For me, I could maybe have done with a bit more development of some of the other characters. There are very few scenes without John Cena on screen that are really fun. There was one with a goose that did make me laugh.
Right, yeah.
Which I thought was quite clever, but generally speaking,
like Zach's meant to be the lead, but
he doesn't get a lot to, and no. Especially compared to something, you know, he's done great work recently in obviously the Iron Claw and things, but he doesn't get a lot to do here. None of the women get any impact whatsoever. The only other person to really make an impact with their screen time, I think, is William H. Macy, who plays the boss of Zac Efron and Andrew Santino's characters.
Yeah.
And he does a lot with his sort of supporting role, and he kind of gets some great moments. But apart from that, this is the John Cena show, and everything he does is pretty great.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I had a lot of fun. Yeah.
And there's a late third act lurch into mawkishness, where people have to learn lessons, they have to repent and find some sort of redemption, and you know the film's kind of striving for emotion, and you can sense that this is the Peter Farrelly who is like, oh, I won an Oscar for Green Book when I did something like this, so maybe I could do that again, and I want to see more of the Peter Farrelly who just with, you know, Dumb and Dumber and Kingpin and There's Something About Mary just went, who gives a shit about emotion? I just want to make people laugh. And I want to see that guy back again, but I fear he is lost to us forever.
Lost to the mists of time.
We don't have an Empire review officially as of yet, but what are we going to give this ourselves personally out of how many Farrellys?
I think it's probably a 3 for me. Like, I had a 3 level of fun with it. I'm not proud of loving it, but I was amused, you know?
I think it is a solidly 2-star film that John Cena kicks into 3-star territory.
I think that absolutely sums it up. Yeah, I would go 3 as well. 3 stars then for Ricky Stenicki. And Imaginary, as I say, we will talk about on next week's show, which leaves Ava DuVernay's Origin. Hell's Bells. Only you here have seen this.
Oh, okay, so this is based on a real journalist called Isabel Wickerson, who wrote a real book called Caste, which is a sort of grand unified theory of discrimination, essentially. So it's not just about racism. It's not just about, you know, sectarianism or anti-Semitism, for example. It's about everything at once. And so the real Isabel Wilkerson is this great kind of thinker who produced this great piece of thinking. Really unusual approach to adapting that book is to essentially look at its creation. So this is about creating a work of nonfiction, but not in the sort of usual racing against the clock kind of, you know, spotlight journalism kind of sense. So Isabel Wilkerson is played by Ingenue Ellis-Taylor, who is phenomenal in this. So this is a very well-established, very successful, very heavyweight journalist, unlike all of us. happily married to a guy called, God help us, Brett, who's played by John Brett. I mean, as a name, come on. I mean, look, it was his name, and he seems like a lovely man, but like Brett.
Brett. Brett from Flight of the Conchords. Brett, you've got it going on.
Brett, you've got it going on, really, when you say it like that.
Oh, Brett. Yeah. Brett.
Anyway, my point is,
Brett.
Played by John Bernthal, full marks there. She's very close to her cousin, played by Niecy Nash. And she starts sort of thinking and working on this as a result of the death of Trayvon Martin. And she's asked by, an old editor friend, played by Blair Underwood, I think, to please, turn her gigantic brain to the cause. And instead, she kind of starts looking into discrimination around the world at different times and different places. She looks at the Dalits in modern India, the so-called untouchables. She looks at Jews in Nazi Germany. She looks at the history of American racism. And she comes up with this sort of grand unified theory. But at the same time, she's going through personal loss, personal tragedies. You know, she's facing putting her mother in a nursing home and losing that kind of family home connection that she's always had and this kind of thing. So it's a very emotional film, and it's a very interesting approach. I don't think it's always 100% successful. I feel like I got the basic concept quite quickly, and the film kind of belabors getting that basic concept. And whereas I think what's really fascinating about what she did is how she broke down the elements of discrimination, the elements of caste. So the fact that members of a lower caste were not allowed to marry the members of a higher caste without being subject to social opprobrium and that kind of thing. That kind of intellectual rigor that she brought to this piece of work that I find really, really fascinating here. So I kind of wish there'd been a bit more of that. That's kind of shoehorned in at the end of the film and kind of like crammed into a very relatively limited space. But I mean, the performances across the board are great. I think Ava DuVernay has a really light touch here. She manages to find the humanity across all the elements of the story, because there's all these kind of flashbacks and, you know, depictions of discrimination and people who have studied this stuff in the past. So she's kind of layering the story in and layering in all these tales from across human history in a way that I thought was really beautifully done. I just felt like I get the basic idea, and you're still telling me about the basic idea, and I want to move on to the next thing. That was my only real note about it. So we gave it 4 stars. It's really, really good film. I'm really surprised actually that this hasn't been in more conversations, especially for Ellis-Taylor's performance. I think it should have been more in the
look when it's been released. Awards. It's been released in March over here.
Well, so over here, that's because I think it sort of died out of the awards season race in the US.
Wow.
Which is a shame. But really worth a look. And I think I certainly want to read the book after this. I haven't got around to it yet, but my to read pile is apocalyptic, so I'm getting there.
Fantastic. 4 stars then for Origin. And I think on that note, that is it, folks.
Bedtime.
For this week's Empire podcast. It's okay, Jimbo, you've only got one more podcast to record after this.
Oh, God, Stu Pilot, kill me.
I've got to race home, watch Imaginary, and then interview DeWanda Waz. And I will not be singing her name to her, although, my God, I want to. I can't be the only person who's made that connection.
You can't be. She's probably really bored of it.
Do you think?
Yeah.
You think?
You think?
You don't think it's just a Chris thing?
No, I'm pretty sure she's heard it before.
I don't know.
Now you want to ask her and find out.
I do want to ask her.
You're going to have to. Now I believe it's your duty.
How would I phrase
that,
though?
Your first question.
DeWanda really enjoyed the film. Really enjoyed the film. Do people sing your name to the tune of Curtis Steiger's 1991 hit, I'm guessing, I Wonder Why? And then she'll go, no. And I'll go,
it's
okay,
just you.
Moving on. and then the interview will be over because she will not be happy. And then she'll start singing it in her head, and then she'll go, oh my God. Oh my God, it fits perfectly. It's not just that it fits perfectly. It's like, it sounds like the lyrics.
Yeah.
You don't understand, Helen.
I do. I really understand. I also have to get home. I've got to do a podcast interview and a piece of radio. So
all right, read it between the lines. I'm saying that you're telling me to wrap up?
Yes.
All right, good stuff. Join us next week for more Film Related Fun. We'll be joined by Ethan Coen.
Woo!
And his wife and co-director of Drive Away Dolls, Trisha Cook. Very, very exciting indeed. And maybe someone else as well, because, you know, it's us and we overbook wildly. But also, do come and see us in Sheffield. We'll be at the Memorial Hall on Wednesday, March 13th, next Wednesday, Sheffield Wednesday. Remember, come along. It's going to be an amazing show. Here is a testimony from someone who saw us in Birmingham and Norwich. What a great show, huh?
That was amazing. I can't believe how great a show that was.
And here's another testimony from a satisfied customer.
Yeah, it was all right.
EmpireOnline.com /pod tour. Dublin nearly sold out. Salford selling really, really well. But we'd love to see as many of you in Sheffield as possible. So there we go.
Please come.
Please come. Absolutely. All right. That's it. It's time to say goodbye to my two colleagues of such lethal cunning. James Dyer.
Good night.
Sleepy time for James. Oh, he's going to be tucked up in his little teddy bear. There's a little bottle of milk.
It's not a bear. It's a sandworm.
And it's not so much a toy as a popcorn bucket.
It's a popcorn bucket. Oh, no. It's goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to blame this entire podcast and everything that happened within it on Ricky Stenicki. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Damn you, Stenicki.
This week's episode of the Empire Podcast was brought to you in partnership with M&M's Chocolate, helping aspiring content creators sweeten their journey towards a career in film.